Well, hello and welcome to the Where's Chronicles podcast. This is the first of what I hope will be a series of conversations, interviews, discussions about the arts in general and the Edinburgh International Festival, Donald Chronicles in particular, adding to and complementing the content we have on where'schronicles.com. To launch this series, I had the opportunity to speak to a very special guest. He began his career some years ago as an assistant conductor in Mannheim. He then moved on to be General Music Director of the City of Freiburg and has recently concluded 17 very successful years as Music Director of San Francisco Opera. Since 2001 he has been Principal Guest Conductor of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and since 2005 Music Director of the Grand Tatum Music Festival. In autumn of last year he moved his focus back towards Europe, taking up the twin posts of Music Director of Deutsche Oper Berlin and chief conductor of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. He is, of course, none other than conductor Donald Chronicles. Now, I'm afraid this is the first interview I've ever conducted, so you'll have to give me if my questions are perhaps a little rambling sometimes and not as focused as I would ideally have liked. You also have to forgive the arrival of the coffee midway through and the attendant noise that made. However, for the most part, you should find it audible and listenable, and I hope you enjoy our discussion. Okay, so I'm joined by Donald Chronicles. Donald, thank you very much for taking time to speak to me.
You're most welcome.
I suppose the question I really have to ask to start with, for the benefit of those listening, where are you?
Oh gosh, there are many mornings in my calendar year that I wake up thinking, where am I actually? I do a lot of travel. I'm in Edinburgh with you at the Usher Hall. It is shortly before our third and final performance of this week's programme with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, a programme of Richard Wagner, Richard Strauss and Ludwig van Beethoven.
And I wonder if you can say maybe a little bit about why the three groups of works you've put on the programme tonight, why those three work together as a programme?
Well, I would say the bookends of the programme, I would hope that that was fairly apparent in that the Richard Wagner made that unforgettable comment about the Seventh Symphony of Beethoven being the apotheosis mm-hmm. of the dance. And I felt it appropriate to then combine the Seventh Symphony with music of Richard Wagner's, which in many ways one doesn't associate dance music too much mm-hmm. with Richard Wagner. But certainly in the opera Tannhäuser, there is that scene, the Venusberg, scene, the Venusberg music, which is sometimes played after the overture, where where Richard Wagner gets to show off, and not only orchestrally, but just the wild rhythms, the wild swirling harmonies, just which in some ways should equally sweep you off your feet, mm-hmm. and of course. Richard Strauss, the songs in the middle, Christine Brewer,
mm-hmm, of course.
The inimitable, the wonderful Christine was available this week, and I thought it then appropriate in between the Richard Strauss and the Beethoven to put these songs which she sings so remarkably, and A Sound World, which is, while certainly having come under the very strong, unavoidable influence of Richard Wagner, is nevertheless quite unique and mm-hmm. quite beautiful.
And I mean, obviously, Brewer is someone you've worked with a number of times, and you've had kind of a lot of successful collaborations from your Tristan recording mm-hmm. and the Ghost of Dam you did at the Proms a few years ago. When did you first work together, and was that chemistry there right from the? You not remember?
I do. Oh no! I remember quite vividly. The first time I heard Christine was actually when she was in San Francisco. I mm-hmm. think she was working with the symphony. And she sang for me. She sang Mozart arias, mm-hmm. and this is many years ago. This was probably 15 years ago. And I was immediately struck by how just beautiful mm-hmm. and natural mm-hmm. this all sounded. But it was actually Paul Hughes at the BBC Symphony who used to actually manage Christine, who brought us together. He told me, Donald, I think you will get on amazingly with Christine. And he was absolutely right. We collaborated in London on the Tristan. We did, oh my goodness, did we do the Guralida together? We had there were various projects that we had, but of course the largest and most exciting was Christine learning the Isolde, the role of Isolde for the first time. And of course I'm steeped in opera, and I love sitting down at the piano and working with singers on repertoire, and it just very, very early on became apparent to me how much chemistry there was between us. And Christine is and this is something that I'm sure many, many players in orchestras will endorse. She is a dream to accompany orchestrally, because she thinks like an instrument. She sings like an instrument. She sees herself as one amongst many. Her reaction to the beat is so natural, and there's never a problem with ensemble. And that's really a unique gift. It's something that not everyone has, and sometimes one has to work very hard on ensemble. So we've always enjoyed working together, whether with the orchestra or whether with the piano.
I mean, I was going to comment on that, because of course in Glasgow you did that rather wonderful recital at the end of the concert.
Oh, were you there?
Well, I was there, because originally I wasn't planning to be in Edinburgh tonight, and then obviously this opportunity came up, so my plans changed. But I still had my tickets, and I thought, well, for this recital, it'd be worth just to see that other side. I mean, I'm aware that perhaps that's something you've done in San Francisco, those sorts of kind of solo recitals.
Yes.
Why particularly would you choose to do that as well as concerts? I mean, what do you find the difference for you is working just one on one like that, as opposed to with the whole orchestra?
There's an intimacy about the one on one, and certainly with singers, with most singers, I try initially to work purely at the piano, whether it's the preparation of a role or just an introduction to an instrumentalist before we rehearse for the first time with an orchestra. Piano is my medium, or it's my instrument, and I personally feel I get a far better feeling for a voice, for the personality, for even a soloist. There are many violinists, for instance, Julian Rachlin, who was with us a few weeks ago. I've done recitals with Julian, and that one-on-one does affect one's work with the orchestra. It's you know one another that much better. And I certainly don't do any solo recital work, but I do still very much enjoy working with singers at the piano, or working in chamber ensembles. And also for me as a musician, in playing by myself, I don't have to tell myself to do things. I'm not standing in front of 90 musicians responsible for the next 2.5 hours of their lives, if you like. I'm only responsible for myself at the piano, and for me it's a very therapeutic exercise.
So I mean, is that something we can perhaps expect to see more of? Because I mean, it certainly was a magical end to the concert, and I certainly think that the people who stayed felt that that was a special
Well, thank you. I'm flattered. I most certainly would like to do more work at the piano with whether singers or instrumentalists. There are so many fantastic pianists though out there. For goodness sake, I'm nowhere near to what you could otherwise hear. But in the context of working with the BBC Scottish and certainly in this rather unique Coda series, I think it's good to show. To have a little variety in the
music. I suppose also what you bring, as opposed to some, you know, terribly brilliant professional pianist, you've got the experience of the opera house, which maybe they don't, so you can translate that, which is a side that perhaps you wouldn't hear if, say, Paul Lewis was accompanying. I mean, he's very good and he does it wonderfully, I don't want to, but there's a different experience that you're bringing maybe to that role than...
Yes, I suppose I certainly think orchestrally when I play the piano, whatever I play actually, and perhaps I think that's a different kind of approach, a different kind of insight.
So, as you mentioned, we're in the Usher Hall, and it's a hall you've had a long, long association with far back before you became a conductor. Can you maybe tell us a bit about your first encounters with this hall?
My first encounters with this hall were all in the auditorium on various levels, mostly in the gods, as a program seller. And I sold programs during the Friday night series of the then SNO, Scottish National Orchestra. I had then a chance, a unique chance, once the programmes were sold, to go and either sit down in a vacant seat or sit down on a step somewhere and lose myself in the vast variety of repertoire that was performed here under the inspired Alexander Gibson. I remember the concerts with Gary Bertini and many guest conductors. But also, of course, I was here during the festival and had the chance to hear some of the world's finest orchestras and some of the world's finest conductors. And most certainly the experience, this weekly experience, had a profound impact on me. It certainly made up my mind that I would want one day to be a conductor. The question was how. But yes, it was a very, very seminal experience here in the Usher Hall.
And of course, you're going to be back here in August for two programmes, one of which is something I'm very excited about, which is Mahler's Eighth Symphony, which I've never heard live before, so it's wonderful that we're going to get the chance to have that here. Of course, it's with the Festival Chorus, who were formed for a performance of Mahler's Eighth some years back. I believe you were involved with that.
Oh gosh, you want to go that far?
Right? Well,
1965, the inaugural concert of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus, and it was Mahler's Eighth Symphony. I think it was either the opening or the closing concert of the Edinburgh International Festival. Arthur Oldham was the chorus master, and I had the thrill of being in the boys' chorus, which was created as well for this occasion. And there's actually a picture which the members of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus, with whom I've subsequently worked a great deal, showed me, where I'm actually standing right behind the horns in 1965. So yes, that was utterly unforgettable. I had no idea then where my life would take me, but
How does it feel now to come full circle and from, you know, writing the boys' choir, and suddenly you're in charge of the whole epic?
The significance of it was certainly not lost to me. I've done Mahler 8 here before. That was with the RSNO back in, I think, in 1993. Or 94. It was one of Arthur Oldham's final years, if not his final season, the legendary Arthur. And it was, yes, I was humbled by the chance to work with Arthur. Bloody brilliant. He was, of course, instrumental in creating this chorus, and this chorus shot to fame through him. But working with him one-on-one and being responsible for the concert was a profound experience.
You've done quite a lot of Mahler, and over at the festival and elsewhere. Do you have any particular conductors of Mahler who you greatly admired, or who you were influenced by? Do you think, or I mean, obviously, I assume you try to do your own thing as well. But who were your?
I think initially I was quite blown away by the Chicago recordings, which Sir George Shulte made in the early 70s. That was an audible love affair with this orchestra. These were the first recordings that came from that remarkable partnership, and I was quite smitten. There was a recording, I remember, though, that really I lived with for months and months and months. It was while I was at university in Edinburgh. I was writing a thesis on Gustav Mahler, the various orchestrations, the corrections he would make, and it was specifically the Fifth Symphony. I was also writing about his tendency to reorchestrate Schumann symphonies and Beethoven symphonies. And anyway, it was during that research that I worked on the Sixth, Mahler's Sixth Symphony, where he made many corrections through the fact that he was a conductor himself.
And of course, swapped the movements around.
Swapped the movements around. It left out a hammer blow and many things. And it was a recording of Sir John Barbarolli with the Philharmonic Orchestra, which I still, to this day, think is one of the most extraordinary performances of that work, and I literally lived with that. I couldn't hear anything else for weeks. And I would say with Bernard Haitink, who was actually made a very profound impression on me, hearing him both live, but hearing his performances, they are enormously honest, enormously humble, and yet beautifully sculpted. And so I've heard many, many Mahler performances, not least the latest performances that Claudio Abbado gave in Berlin, which have been thankfully recorded and recorded for posterity. And of course, this was after he himself had been through this existential crisis, and where he was really almost came back from the dead. And that one of those, I think it's the Mahler, the sixth, which was recorded soon after he had made this remarkable recovery. It's just, it's not to read too much into it, but you, a unique performance.
But one finds that with those sorts of performances, to have those stories behind that. I mean, there's that newish disc from Leon Fleischer, where he first got his hands back, and you know, one wonders how much you read into that, because it feels all the more poetic, maybe, because there's that story behind it, and it's more remarkable for it, I suppose. So, I mean, generally, how much do you listen to recordings or to performances of whatever conductors are doing to inform your own approach then?
Well, I don't think that is what actually happens. I certainly listen to many performances of other conductors. I still do. I mean, it's just for sheer pleasure. It's interesting. It's always interesting to hear what other people have to say about something. And I don't think it informs you in that you can ever copy.
Well, you wouldn't want to try and be someone else, because you'd never.
Well, no, you
don't think anyone ever would.
And you may find a rubato there, or a sudden dynamic shift somewhere else, fascinating and insightful. In which case, yes, my goodness, if it makes sense, if it's something you yourself may have overlooked, then that is to say, I think though, that anybody who claims not to have heard other recordings or other people, I think they're missing out on an awful lot, because I don't think. It's not as if you can cheat and copy it. But, of course, I always go back and listen to old recordings, and there are more and more now made available. Music and Arts, the organization based in San Francisco, actually, are reissuing more and more of old recordings that have been, if you like, freed up in Russia or in Vienna, old studio recordings of various works. And I was just recently listening to some previously unissued performances of Charles Munch in Boston, and also in Paris, and it's hair-raisingly exciting music making. And when you hear that, you only wish you could have actually been in the audience. But I find things like that just utterly fascinating.
So you're coming now to the end of your first season, more or less, as chief conductor of the BBC Scottish. What do you think have been the highlights for you of this first year? Or has
you know, I was. It's not in order to in any way sound clever, but every week with this orchestra for me is a highlight. I look back on the whether it was. The Beethoven one, the Mahler one we did together. Look back on the James's work, James Milne, the Confessions, the Confession of Isabel Gowdy. I look back on the Bruckner. They really are. This is an extraordinary orchestra, and I'm privileged indeed to be at their helm. And as I say, each week for me is in some way a highlight.
I don't suppose you can give us any flavour of what's coming next year, or do we have to wait until, I think, the 12th of April it is?
I think you're going to have to hang on there. But there are many, I hope, appealing programmes, and I enjoy programming. I enjoy putting works together and looking for, not necessarily a theme, but like a good menu, if you like, what goes with what.
I mean, one thing certainly that was very interesting this year was the Daphnis and Chloe, because of course that was a collaboration with the Festival Chorus, and that's unusual for them to have anything to do outside of the festival. Was it always something you were keen to foster in coming here, or...?
I would put that slightly differently, in that at Revel, the Daphnis score has always been one of my all-time favourite scores. For a long, long time, I know in Germany, at my piano, I would always have a full score of the Daphnis open, just to inspire me. I love the score, and very soon after I was appointed chief conductor here, I spoke with Gavin and said it's a piece I would love to do. I think it's a work which many people think they know through the suites, but when you hear the suite in the context of the entire ballet, I think you hear it completely differently. And it's a wonderful journey to make with an orchestra. All those sounds, all those atmospheric moments in that score are just unbelievable. I think the orchestra enjoys playing it too.
So is that collaboration with the Festival Chorus outside of festival time something we can maybe expect to see more of?
It's something we would like to explore, most certainly.
Which brings me, I think, on to something else, which is obviously you're a conductor deeply steeped in the opera house, and indeed most of your career, and certainly your principal appointments, have been opera-based rather than normally. I mean, you've had Atlanta as a guest, and now, of course, you've got this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that's likely to inform any programming in the future? Because in Scotland, we don't perhaps have as much opera as such as myself would ideally like. And just from a personal perspective, it'd be fabulous to see some concert opera, you know, staged in the the regular season, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I have every intention of doing some concert opera here. And the driving force behind that is what the orchestra gets out of it. It's I've obviously whether it was in London with the Tristan with the BBC Symphony, or of course here with the Trojans, subsequently the Electro, the BBC Scottish. I marvel at just how differently a symphony orchestra comes to this repertoire, because they either have never played it or never played it in its entirety. They most certainly haven't sat in a pit. Their relationship to it is a very fresh one. And in addition to which, I think that there are... not every opera lends itself to being performed in concert, but some of these bigger ones, I think it, for an audience too, it's you hear it differently. And the one-on-one experience of a singer standing right next to you. We did just last week, I did a concert at the Deutsche Oper with the Deutsche Oper Orchestra. This was the first symphony concert we'd done together, and we did a program, Debussy, a symphony created by the composer and conductor Marius Constant from the Debussy score. About a half an hour of music and ravishing. And then we did the second act of Parsifal in concert. Now, of course, the Deutsche Oper has this long tradition with the Wagner, and they know it fairly well, but even they themselves were surprised, happily surprised, at how it felt to be front and centre on the stage. Everybody could see them, and there are just voices in that orchestra which you perhaps don't readily hear in the pit. And so, yes, you can expect some concert opera in the future.
Excellent. Now, obviously, you've just moved to Deutsche Oper, and before that you were in San Francisco for, I think, 17 years, or thereabouts. Has that been a big change in terms of how the two companies are, or has it been easy to go from one to the other?
They're two very different companies by their very nature. The one is a stagione house. In other words, it's... one does one piece, or prepares one piece at a time. You run it for six times, and then it's gone. It's not peppered through the season, if you like. Whereas in Germany, or certainly at the Deutsche Oper, you have what is called the repertoire system, whereby you prepare a piece as in a new production, but you may do it for three or four times, and then it'll come back in the season for another three or four times. So you build up a number of works over that season. This season, I think we had 35 different titles. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different, whereas in San Francisco, you'd have nine, perhaps, through the whole season. And not to mention the fact that Berlin has a season all year. Mm-hmm. San Francisco has two periods in a year. So it's different. I don't work with the musicians any differently. I don't work with the music staff or with the singers any differently. But one has a different approach to... You can't rehearse in a house like the Deutsche Oper, where the focus is on performance, where you'll do perhaps 150, 200 performances a year. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can't rehearse everything quite as much as you would normally, because you literally just don't have the time. So you will find, and therein lies a wonderful challenge. You will find after 4 or 5 months a Tristan or a Pelléas appears on the repertoire, on the program again, and you haven't rehearsed it with the orchestra in 4 or 5 months, but they develop this remarkable memory for what you've done, and so there's a great variety to what you're doing in any given week. So they're different. The music making is the same, but the discipline of putting on opera is different.
But does that perhaps mean then that there are some productions it would perhaps be difficult to mount in that context? I mean, I'm thinking of some of the things you've done in San Francisco, like the premiere of Dr. Atomic, mm-hmm. or the American premiere of St. Francis, which I imagine are works that require an awful lot of rehearsal. I mean, particularly St. Francis, just for the scale of it and the huge orchestration and so forth.
They require a great deal of rehearsal, and one of the big differences is that in a stagione house, as in San Francisco, you can build up a set and you can have it on stage for 3 or 4 days. You can do all your big piano rehearsals, do your orchestral rehearsals, do then the first performance. And San Francisco has a slightly bigger number of operas than a lot of other American houses. But what I'm saying is that you don't have that requirement that you would have in a repertoire house to have a production which you can build in the morning, mm-hmm. perform at night, take apart, in order that another opera is performed the next evening. So that brings with it logistic challenges and limitations, where you just cannot take on anything just because you think it's going to be great. We've just been in Berlin. We're in negotiation with Paris at the moment, working on a production of Romeo and Juliet, which we most definitely want to bring to the Deutsche Oper. And our technical team went over in order to find out that it's too big. You would have to... Nothing else could be performed around it, so to speak. And so we're making modifications. But yes, that's a very big consideration.
I mean, thinking about things like Dr. Atomic, is it easier to prepare an opera when you're working with a composer who's alive, who you can kind of phone up and say, should this sound like this? Or is it harder because in some ways, if the composer's dead, you know, they can't come and complain if they don't like how you...
Well, I wouldn't...
Or just different.
Put it quite so morbid.
I didn't mean to be morbid, but...
I would say rather... It's a very different experience. If you're working with a John Adams and a Dr. Atomic, you can be pretty sure that the version that you are giving is not going to be the definitive version. He will make modifications based upon this, based upon rehearsals. And one can only assume that all the great works of dead composers that we perform have gone through a similar process when they were being rehearsed and performed and through different editions. I mean, you're back now.
Think things like Don Carlos, which went through more editions than one can...
Boccanegra, look at that. I mean, one assumes that version that you're performing of Fidelio or of Figaro, that is the definitive, the final version. So yes, you can't perhaps read the composer's mm-hmm. minds as well as you can when a composer can actually mm-hmm. tell you, well, that's what I was going for, Donald. Or, It's an incredibly exciting experience to be a midwife at, at the birth of a new opera such as Dr. Tomic. And John's presence at rehearsals, Peter Sellers being such an integral part of the production and the actual work itself, that's a great thrill. And I mean, it would be fascinating, wouldn't it, if somehow we could experience Richard Wagner, or Richard Wagner was suddenly available, and you could ask him questions. What did you mean by this, and what did you mean by that? On a similar topic, I marvel at when I read, when I see the facsimiles or the original orchestral scores of a Tristan or a Parsifal. It's a weakness of mine to buy these scores, and to see how few corrections he made, and how corrections somehow were in his head, and then the final version was very often the version that was put down there. I think perhaps composers these days, in that they can use all this software available to them, feel they can just print out something and then make changes and just see how it sounds and go back and tweak it. And it didn't quite work that way 100 years ago, 200 years ago.
And if we stay with Wagner for a moment, you've worked, I believe, at Bayreuth in the past. What's that like as a house to conduct in? Because, of course, it's completely physically, it's very different from what most people are familiar with as an opera house, perhaps.
I worked many years in Bayreuth. I began as an assistant, coach, repetitor. In 1982 with Jamie Devine, Parsifal, assistant George Schulte for The Ring, Hochstein, Meistersinger, a variety of things. So I got to know the house literally from the bottom up. And I was out in the house listening to other conductors rehearsing works, and really experienced the house on a very, very profound level. So that when I did actually conduct, it was Tannhäuser for 4 years, 92 to 96, I knew what the challenges of the house were. And one of the biggest challenges is the fact that the way you hear the stage is not the way you would hear it out in the auditorium. And the stage, when I say the stage, the singers, yes, because of the cover, over the shell, over the orchestra pit, the orchestral sound goes straight to the stage, first of all, it's directed out to the stage, and then out into the auditorium. And what that results in is a delay of the orchestral sound in the auditorium, which leads to the rather extraordinary experience for the stage, that is to say, the singers in the chorus, they have to drag the beat. Right. If they sing with the beat, they're too early when you listen to it in the house. And of course, that runs completely contrary to what all singers, all choruses have otherwise always heard. It's this negative image of any other opera house, which leads to interesting ensemble issues. I remember Sir George Schulte was... it drove him insane that what he heard always sounded as if it was late. Yes, it was late for him. In the house, it was correct. And he was always trying to get the... bring the stage back onto his beat, and it was an extraordinary thing. And somehow you have to be able to lean back and just trust the fact that the singers, many of whom do sing in Bayreuth every year, they know what they're doing. The chorus has chorus assistants, both left and right, on towers, obviously invisible to the audience, with little torches, little lamps, and they deliberately delay the conductor's beat. They see it, they have headphones on, they conduct, I know, a quarter of a second behind. And if you see it, it would drive you insane as a conductor, down in the pit, but they do that. And the chorus is instructed not to look at the principal conductor, because they're instructed to look peripherally to the left or the right in order for their reaction to the beat to be correct. And weird and wonderful.
And of course, you were saying about how wonderful to be able to call up Wagner and say, well, what did you mean by this or that? But of course, one thing we we do know is that he didn't want Parsifal performed anywhere but by right. Now, I take it you've... I mean, maybe you haven't done it elsewhere.
Cosima.
But
Cosima insists that Richard Wagner did not want it to be performed anywhere else.
Ah, but is the actual truth of the matter more...
I think the truth of the matter is more that Cosima Wagner was the... she was somewhat the Darth Vader in all of this, and the faithful hound.
So it's almost a bit like the situation with Alma Mahler and the movement toward Edward VI.
Yes. No, Cosima was very, very protective of her husband and her husband's works, and long after Richard Wagner's death, she fought the performance of Parsifal anywhere besides in Bayreuth, and I believe it was when it was done in New York for the first time. It was regarded as a great affront to Bayreuth, and of course Bayreuth had many singers who would perform worldwide, and it led to a great deal of friction with other opera companies. But everybody was dying to get their hands on this, on Richard Wagner's final opera.
Well, I'll just ask you one final question I make, because I'm aware Stephen wants you to... you need to get ready for your...
Yes, I do.
Concert. One of the things that often strikes me about performances that you do, and particularly the first few I heard at the 2005 festival, which was the Verdi Requiem and the Mahler Third, was your attention to detail in placing offstage instruments, and particularly the balance you got with the post horn in that Mahler Third. Is that something you put a lot of thought into and a lot of time in rehearsal to get just... I mean, I noticed in the rehearsal this afternoon moving the horns around in the Beethoven 7 just to get the...
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is, very much so. I mean, I do live a lot of my life in the opera house, and so did Gustav Mahler when it comes to the spatial effects that he looks for in his symphonies. There is something, this third dimension in music that he's always looking to find. Where the orchestra is middle distance and far distance. So I take trouble over it because I feel an audience also wants to feel engulfed and be in this sound world, and being in the sound world implies a third dimension. It's drawing an audience in, and you draw an audience in sometimes by that very feeling that they're not quite sure where's this coming from, and whether...
Absolutely.
You...
I mean, it's the effect that you can't get on a CD. That's the magical thing about it. And I mean, I was at the... I heard Janssen and the Concertgebouw do the second not too long ago, and they had... it was in the Barbican, and you'd have the offstage brass in about four different places, and it was... you know, you just can't buy that kind of effect.
You can't, and that really, I've learned, and that's probably through my experience in the opera house. You do leave a lot of time to do those special effects. I mean, when we placed the offstage trumpets in the Mahler 1, which we began this season, we took a lot of trouble here, just opening doors, having the door half open, playing towards me, playing away from me. Should it sound as if they're playing fortissimo, but playing a long, long way away, in which case it sounds piano, or do you get them to be a little quieter? All these sort of things. I just personally love doing it, and if it works, nobody is happier than I am. But I think for the audience too, it's really a feeling of you're transported to another place, and ultimately that's what I'm about. I'm the custodian, if you like, of that.
It certainly is. Well, Donald, thank you very much for talking to me. It's
you're most welcome.
A tremendous pleasure.
You're most welcome.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Well, that more or less concludes the first Where's Ronicles podcast. I hope there's another one before too long. In the meantime, you can continue to enjoy our regular views and comments on where'sronicles.com. Before I finish up, there are just one or two people I'd like to thank. First of all, Mark Rock of Audio Boo, first for hosting this podcast and then for tweaking my account so that it could deal with files this big and this long. Top cellist and tweeter Peter Gregson for suggesting Audio Boo and then putting me in touch with Mark. More particularly, Stephen Duffy and the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra for arranging this interview. And, of course, Donald Ronicles. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed or found something informative or got something from listening. In the meantime, it remains only for me to, in the words of one of my favourite broadcasters, wish you good night and good luck.